Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
It is my great pleasure to introduce New York Times bestselling author of Labor Day, The Good Daughters, Joyce Maynard. She will be talking about her newest book, which I just finished last night, and it was wonderful. It's called After Her. Joyce has been a New York Times reporter, a syndicated columnist. She teaches writing, an essayist, and we all know she's one of the finest authors in this whole nation, in my opinion, anyway. She just returned from Telluride Film Festival, where Labor Day has premiered, the Jason Reitman film from her book, Labor Day, and I'm sure she'll probably talk about that. So please welcome Joyce Maynard.
What a nice introduction.
Thank you so much. It is such a pleasure to be. This is one of my very favorite bookstores. And I'll tell you, you know, the current wisdom in the world of publishing is that readings like this one really are kind of an anachronism, that that's no longer the way people sell books and, you know, get their books out to the masses. And no doubt that is true. But for me, and so I'm not actually coming to a lot of bookstores. I don't have a tour. But there were a couple of stores that I just wanted to go to, and towns that I wanted, cities that I wanted to go to, and this was one. Tattered Cover has always been such a welcoming place for me. And it's really important for me. This is the little gift that I give myself after the hard work of writing a book. What I do is a pretty lonely occupation. I have to sit by myself in a room for a long time to write a book. And every now and then, I finish one and I get to go out in the world for a little bit and meet you. So that's my way of saying I hope I'm really going to hear from you tonight. I'm going to read a little bit from this book, and I'm always happy to talk. I can talk forever. But my real hope is that I hear what's on your mind. So we'll just have a conversation about this book, about other books. This year, 2013, marks the 40th anniversary of the publication of my first book when I was 19 years old. I'll be 60 in November. You can do the math. That was a book called Looking Back. My gosh. I usually know there's going to be a few 1953 babies in the group. And there aren't a lot of people who are still around who are publishing books in 1973. So I just want to express to you, before anything else, my gratitude for continuing to read my work. It's... There are people who write and teach or write and, you know, have a day job. And I just write. That's what I do. And I've just done that for 40 years. And I wouldn't have been able to do that. I can't say it's always been easy. It has not. If it weren't for you. So thank you so much. Because I love what I get to do. And I hope I'll continue to be able to do it for a long time. I also want to mention, and maybe we'll get to this tonight, maybe we won't, that in addition to the fact that I have this book just out, it was published last week, and this book that was published a few years ago but is just coming out as a movie very soon, and I just got to see the absolute first ever showing here in Colorado 2 days ago at Telluride. Today is a very significant publishing day in another way. 15 years ago this month, I published my memoir, At Home in the World. And it was a book that it took a huge amount of heat, a lot of criticism, And I won't even say the book took criticism. It was me very personally. The book was called by the Washington Post the worst book ever published. There was an editorial actually written about me in the New York Times. I guess I should be proud of that. I was called a predator. Anyway, for reasons that we can explore or not tonight, it became really important to me. This book is very dear to my heart, and I always hoped that it would get a new reading. This week, a film about which I have some conflicted feelings, having to do with J.D. Salinger, who is only a part of this story, of my story. That film is being released, as is a big blockbuster, no doubt best-selling book about Salinger. I saw the film yesterday at Telluride for the first time. I knew I would be in it, but I had no idea what the film would ultimately be, and it was shown at Telluride. So it was really important to me, knowing that I would be talked about, which has been, like it or not, a big part of my story for the last 40 years also, that people have the opportunity to hear my story from me, not what people think about me, but what I have to say. And so I worked really hard to bring out a new edition of At Home in the World with a new preface and a new photograph, which is kind of important. The cover isn't always so important, but the photograph is a picture of me taken in the spring of 1973, also 40 years ago right now, very shortly after one of the most devastating events in my life. I hated the photograph when it was taken. It was taken by a very famous photographer, Richard Avedon, but it didn't make me look pretty. When I was 19, that's what I, you know, was concerned about. But actually, it is a portrait of the devastation that I felt at the time. So I managed to get that photograph. It was a big job doing that for the cover of that book. And here it is, the new edition of At Home in the World, which just became available today. So that's also here, and maybe we'll talk about that as well a little bit. But I first want to talk about After Her, which is my new book, because ultimately what interests me much more than old stories from long ago is the stories of now. So I'll give you a little bit of back story of how I came to write this book. I'm from New Hampshire. I come from a small town in New Hampshire. There's actually someone here tonight who comes from the one town over, which is really nice for me to see and know. I grew up in New Hampshire and always longed to get to the big city and explore the world. And it took me a while to do that, but 17 years ago, after my marriage was long over and my children were sort of somewhat launched in the world, my daughter was graduating from high school, I moved to California. I didn't know a soul in the state of California. It was a pretty naive thing to do, to just sort of get on a plane and say, now we're going to live in San Francisco Bay Area. But that's what we did. And I felt drawn to cross the Golden Gate Bridge and took the exit kind of blind for a town called Mill Valley. And I saw this mountain. And I was just drawn to this mountain, maybe because I come from New Hampshire. And I went to a real estate open house. There was a house for sale on that mountain that cost way more than I had any business buying, but this was California, and this was 1996, where all things were possible. And so I bought the house on the mountain in Mill Valley, California, and every morning of my life for the last 17 years, I've gotten up and had my coffee. I'm an early riser, and watched the sunrise over this mountain, Mount Tamalpais. And I was dimly aware of the fact that some very dark and sinister events had taken place there long ago, that there had been some murders on that mountain. But I was focused more on the beauty of the mountain. I hiked that mountain almost every day. And then 2.5 years ago, I should say that I sometimes host writing workshops in my house, just a one-day workshop where I people come over to my house and we talk about how they might tell their story. Not necessarily professional writers or writers at all, but I love to help people tell their story. So two women, sisters in their 40s, younger than me significantly, but showed up at my writing workshop, which is in my living room, and we look out at that mountain. That mountain is in our faces. And when it got time to hear their stories, it turned out that a big part of their story was that they were the daughters of the homicide detective who had been in charge of the investigation of the series of killings on that mountain where he hiked every day. It was known, they were known as the Trailside Killings. And they went on for 2 years between 1979 and 1981. And many people who lived there then are still haunted by that event. Now, I'm not really, fundamentally, my big interest is not in serial killers. I'm more interested in the so-called ordinary people who never end up being very ordinary at all. I'm interested in families and husbands and wives, parents and children, brothers and sisters, sisters and sisters. And there were these two sisters sitting in my living room. And they were now in their 40s. It was over 30 years since those killings were over. Their father was long dead. He had actually died in his early 40s, very shortly after the arrest of the killer, and he had not ever succeeded in getting that killer. Somebody else had in another jurisdiction. And they were convinced that it was the experience of trying to solve that those killings that had killed their father. And they had grown up. They were 13 and 11 when the killings began. And 30-some years later, they were still haunted by them. And that's the kind of moment when the little story bell goes off in my head. And I'm not the daughter of a detective, and I did not have a relationship with my own sister. I'm the youngest of two. Anything like these two women who were so bonded. You could just feel it in that room. They were totally different, but they could finish each other's sentences. There was nothing but love and support for each other. It was an extraordinary thing to witness. But 30 years later, you could tell that this event had just haunted them and shaped their lives. And I love these two women. They were just wonderful. Laura and Janet are their names. They've become good friends. One of them became my dental hygienist. You seldom met a person who gets her teeth cleaned more than me now, because she's such a great one. But they stayed after the workshop was over, and we were washing the dishes in my kitchen together, and we were continuing to talk about the experience of growing up in the shadow of these serial killings. And Laura, who's a very together woman, happily married, raising children, you know, doing well in Ukiah, California, told me that around about her 40th birthday, she had made the decision, her sister hated this decision, to write a letter to the Trailside Killer, who is on death row at San Quentin. He's the oldest occupant of death row, now in his 80s, asking if she could pay him a visit. And he said yes, and she did pay him a visit. Pretty extraordinary thing for a mom from Ukiah, California to do. And she went. I said, what were you expecting to have happen there? And she said, you know, my father never got a confession from him. Nobody ever did. And in her magical thinking, she was a smart, you know, sophisticated woman in her 40s, but she went with the dream that she might finally extract a confession from this man. And she said, you know, I just wanted to look him in the eye. I felt I wanted to understand. She said, I lost my father so young, and I thought maybe sitting in that room with the killer, I would understand something about what he had gone through. And I didn't, is what she said. But that was the moment that I knew this was a story that I wanted to explore. I'd never had an experience like this, but the idea of being haunted into adult, mature life by the experiences of one's youth and adolescence is something that I could certainly relate to, and I bet many people here can. And so I asked these two women who had no aspiration to write this story themselves. I would never rip off anybody's story, wanted to tell it themselves, whether they would allow me to explore their story in a work of fiction. And the great gift, I did not say I want to tell what happened to you. They gave me a bigger gift, which was the gift of allowing me to invent as I chose. And I invented very freely. If you're going to pay $25 for a book, I want to give you a really good story. And I didn't want to be bound by just what actually happened. I wanted to make it the absolute best story it could be. And they said yes. And in fact, more than saying yes, they helped me extraordinarily. Neither one is a writer, but they made me a whole loose leaf binder of everything I needed to know about 1979 in Marin County, California, and being the daughter of a detective. Their parents were divorced. They were actually, their family was broke. In those days, you could be a broke person living in Marin County, California. And there were all these little categories, you know, the music they listened to and the clothes that they coveted and the TV shows they watched. But much more than that, you know, the mood of that time and that place and their family. And that was the origin of this book, which I worked on it. Actually, normally I write a book pretty fast. My novel Labor Day was actually written in 12 days. It was kind of a, you know, this surprising gift that I got, that it just came to me. This was not true of After Her. I've worked on this book for over 2 years, and it was a much more complicated story because it is both a love story and a family story and a thriller. But I'm going to read you just a very little bit from After Her, and then I hope we'll talk about whatever's on your mind. The novel, I should say, is narrated in the voice of the older sister, who has become a writer. And she's now in her 40s, but she's looking back over the summer of 1979, the years 1979 to 1981, when she and her sister were coming of age, her sister's 11, in the shadow of this mountain and these killings, and the shadow of a divorced family and a father, an absolutely irresistible, adored father who is both, in, you know, just a extraordinarily charismatic and charming man, a man whose ex-wife describes him as a man who loved women, just too many of them, who is the all-powerful, larger-than-life hero until he cannot catch this killer, and they watch him going down. And the narrator, the 13-year-old version of the narrator, whose name is Rachel, takes it upon herself to try and help her father catch the killer by setting herself up as bait for the killer. And, you know, one little, I think it was somebody writing on Amazon.com, their, you know, review of the book, and they said, the plan that she cooked up for catching this killer is so unbelievable. To which I say, yeah, that was the point. I'm actually very proud of having created my, you know, what a 13-year-old would think would be a way to catch the killer, except that horrifyingly, it sort of works. And that's part of the story. But this is the very beginning of After Her, in the voice of the adult Laura, adult Rachel, looking back. Laura is my real friend. Nothing much ever happened on the mountain where we lived growing up, and we didn't get cable. We were always hoping for a little excitement. So my sister and I made up situations. All we had was time. One day, we decided to see what it felt like to be dead. If a person's dead, they don't feel anything, Patty said. This was Patty for you. I had a red sweatshirt, the kind with a zipper up the front and a hood and pockets to keep gum. I spread it on a patch of grass on the hillside behind our house, with the sleeves stretched out as if they were a person who'd been run over by a truck, the hood off in a different direction, so as much of the red part showed as possible, like a pool of blood. Lie there, I told my sister, pointing to a spot in the middle over the zipper part. She might disagree, but Patty nearly always did what I told her. If she had questions, she kept them to herself. I lay down next to her, close enough so plenty of the red part showed on either side of our bodies. Now what? Don't move. Don't let your chest go up and down when you breathe. Some people would have asked for an explanation, but not Patty. Letting her find out in her own time was part of my idea, and she understood this. For a long time, nothing happened. It was hot that day, but we just lay there. "My nose itches," she said. "Never mind," I told her. "Just think about something else, something interesting." For me at the time, that would mean Peter Frampton or the jeans I'd seen at the mall a couple of weeks earlier that were perfect in every way except the price. And the notebooks I wrote in where I made up stories I'd read to my sister that she said were better than Nancy Drew. For Patty, it would be Larry Bird executing a hook shot or some dog she liked, which would be any dog that ever lived. "Did you notice that cloud?" she said. "It's shaped like a dachshund." Quiet. Who knew how much time passed? 10 minutes? An hour, possibly. Then I spotted it. A vulture circling above our heads. First one, then two more. They were high up still, but it was plain from where they'd positioned themselves that we were the target. The place they were circling was directly over the spot where we lay. "What now?" Patty asked me. "Shush, be still." Two more birds joined the others. The circle was getting tighter, as if they were zeroing in. They were coming lower too, closer to our bodies. "What if they try to peck our eyes out?" No answer from me. Getting the vultures to spot us was the whole point. My sister should know this, and basically did. The vultures were swooping lower now, dive bombing, making this terrible shrieking sound. They were closing in around us, shrieking not so much at Patty and me from the sound of it as at one another. They were fighting over who would get to eat our eyeballs, probably. Then came one final shriek. Not from one of the nearest birds, but one we hadn't noticed until now, a little farther off, but zeroing in. He sailed down toward us, body like an arrow, beak and talons aimed at our faces. I didn't have to tell my sister what to do. We jumped up screaming, running down the mountain toward our house. No time to claim my sweatshirt even, though later, when the birds were gone, we'd return for it, out of breath, and holding each other, screaming. A person could scream as loud as she wanted on the mountain, and it felt good. We were always looking for excuses to scream.
You were laughing, and I'm wondering if you know, if are there some bird people here? Probably you would know that vultures wouldn't actually do that. And that also is the point. This is a story about the wild imaginations of young girls and the capacity of a girl at a particular age to cook up all sorts of drama and to imagine that all things are true and real that may not be. Which can lead to a whole lot of trouble. And of course, that's really bad in life or in parenthood and really good in a novel. So, you know, I can read more, talk more, tell more stories, but I would rather, if you're up for it, hear what's on your minds about absolutely anything. So go for it and let's talk. Yes. Yes.
Aside from the fact that he did confess to her, did she come away with any impressions, or was she affected by it?
She, what she came away with was a huge sense of emptiness, actually. That, and it was really that emptiness that you know. Sometimes what a writer does is tell what happens, and sometimes we tell what should have happened. And I recognized that this was an open question. And I wanted to imagine how it might be closed. So, in a funny way, I actually think that the experience, and this is, you know, this is no reason for anybody to read the book but them, but for them,
it actually did accomplish that. In fact, the first people, when I wrote this book, normally I, you know, mail it right off to my agent, my editor. I called Laura and Janet, and I invited them over to my house. And Laura had to drive some distance. They both had young kids. They had to, like, make sure that their kids were all taken care of. And they showed up at my house at about 7:30 in the morning, and they had made a big pot of really strong coffee. And it was a rainy spring day in Marin County, so I built a big fire, and we settled in on the couch, and I began to read this book out loud. And by the time I finished the 400 and some pages that the manuscript was, it was 8:30 at night, and we were into the red wine heavily. And they had cried a few times, and I have to say, laughed a few times. I like it that this. I think this book is sort of scary and chilling at some times, and I hope it's funny. I think it is funny at some times too. It's very much a novel about what it is to be a 13-year-old girl. Yes.
Young girl who had father issues, if I may, right? He
busted.
But I mean, he knew that. He knew that. So when he was done, regardless of him as a writer, you were suffering from severe PTSD that was never treated. So what I find interesting is, congratulations, first of all, if you don't mind me saying so, on your marriage.
Thank you. I just got married.
Only
took me 59 years to make a healthy relationship.
But I bring it up because isn't it interesting that perhaps now, as a happy person, you can revisit the J.D. Salinger issue from a place of saying, let's not glorify mental illness. While he was a fantastic writer, probably bipolar, and hurt you for your entire life, we need to get him off the pedestal and say, let's take the writing. The writing might be brilliant, but this is somebody who ruined a lot of lives who needed probably treatment mentally.
Well, and, you know, my purpose, I'll say, Molly, I actually wrote this book. The original version of this book was published 15 years ago, and no man had come galloping in on a white stallion at that point. And I like to think that that ultimately it's not, you know, any man, good as he may be, that saves us. It's we save ourselves. I dealt with that experience some time ago, but long after I had dealt with it, the world still was coming at me and still does on a daily basis. There has seldom been a day in the last 40 years that I am not asked about this. And it's an odd thing to combine with my life as a writer. I mean, this book has absolutely nothing to do with Salinger. This book has absolutely nothing to do with Salinger. I've written 13 books, 12 of which have absolutely nothing to do with Salinger. I have many other stories to tell, but that one, that is one of my stories, not the story. But you're absolutely right that, I mean, this book was extraordinarily attacked when it was published. And it's a very, it's a very meaningful thing. I didn't even criticize. I just told the story. I never actually. Yes, it was. There was an unwritten code surrounding Salinger that one must never speak of him. And there's this film that has come out now, you know, would seem to break new ground. Although I would say it still sanitizes to a significant degree the extent of the dysfunction that was going on there. But I'm not one to criticize the film. I'm only there to say I look forward to and hope for the day when the story of an 18-year-old girl who was pursued by a 53-year-old man could be read without the interpretation made that somehow to speak of this was predatory and exploitative behavior on the part of the girl.
What happened when you went to see?
You know, I really, this is not like a cheap shot way of getting you to read the book, but I will say I would do a disservice to that story to simply just sort of summarize it. It's the end of the book. It was there in the old book too. But
I've read this three times.
Oh, well, go back. Go back. I went when I was 44 years old. It was kind of interesting because, Barbie, because I had lived within an hour of his house for 25 years. I was married, raising my children, and I never felt that I could ever go see him again, although that experience had a profound effect on me. But when my daughter turned 18, I made this decision, and I decided I wanted to go see him. And I had a serious question to ask him, and that is the kind of the final or the penultimate scene in the book where I go and knock at his door. And I know it's a, I don't want to believe that it's because I didn't write a very memorable scene that you've forgotten.
It's just I'm
getting old. It's no. It's so yes. Karen.
Joyce, looking back now, if you had known, and I know you're a very brave person, and I think it's incredible, it's so wonderful that you have a re-release of At Home in the World with a new preface. I think that is a wonderful strategy. It's just an excellent move right now with the assault of the film and all that. But if you had known how the world, especially the publishing world, would have treated you after your memoir,
no. And the cost was huge. I mean, the book really destroyed my career for a long time. And had it not been for Labor Day, it would be destroyed still, probably. No, it wouldn't. I would have figured out. I would have created a new whole name or whatever. But in fact, Labor Day had to be sold anonymously. I was told by an agent, this book must be submitted without your name attached to it. But the answer is no. I'm a parent. And I think, you know, one of the jobs that we have as parents is to, you know, is to model a behavior that we believe is, you know, the right way to be. And I had no shame. And I don't want to live as a fearful person. And you know, the consequences were large. But the people that I, you know, what is our life for? Just to be comfortable? So I don't regret publishing that book. It's probably just as well that I didn't know when I was writing it what it would bring onto me. But I'm proud of it, and I fought dearly and paid a big price for publishing it. And so it feels very good to, you know, to have it available again. Yeah. Yes.
I find myself.
Are you a writer? The definition of a writer is somebody who writes. It is not like, have you published anything or are people paying you?
That's a dissertation. After that, I didn't
want
to write for a long time.
Great. Yes. You can call yourself a writer. Oh, don't let yourself. I mean,
and that's what I'm asking. So
I understand that. Look where we're standing here, and I sometimes do walk into a bookstore and I think, do they really need more books? What that does for me is, I find I need to know your name just so I can say it. Jeanette, what that does for me, Jeanette, is inspire me to give you nothing but the best. The world does not need another mediocre book. And unless I'm going to write something really good, I won't do it. That is true. And I take very seriously. I'm a person that, you know, has had financial struggles at various points all her life. I take seriously just what a book costs. So no, I'm not going to do it lightly. I'm not going to put something out there that I don't totally believe in. I actually finished this book a year ago, and my editor liked it, and they were going to publish it, and I didn't think it was quite right. And so I spent another whole year. That's a year's salary, basically. Another whole year, and there's no like salary for me if I do that. But I really believe that there's always room for authentic writing.
Can you talk for just a little bit about how you came about your love of writing and what helped you develop and how you got to bring it?
Thank you. Sure. And once again, I don't want to be seen. That's a big part of what At Home in the World is about, actually, because much more than Salinger, it is the story about a writer's journey. My parents were my first and best teachers. And both of them were lovers of the English language. And there were some problems in this. I won't say that it was an easy way to grow up in this kind of boot camp of writing. I always say, and it's true, before I could physically write, I gave dictation. My mother wrote down everything that I, you know, my stories, typed them up, and then we discussed them and figured out how to make them better. And we didn't, the bad part was, you know, not a piece of sporting equipment ever crossed our threshold. But I mean, our family sport was writing, and we told stories, we wrote them up, we sat around in our living room, we read them out loud. My mother was an absolutely brutal critic. I've worked with countless numbers of editors in New York City, never one who was as demanding as my mother. When my mother died, which was 25 years ago, way too young, and I was way too young to lose her, and I had to clear out her house very fast because the house was going on the market, and I thought, where do I begin? It was like there was a fire, you know, what do I save? And in her basement, there were these boxes of manuscripts, my writings, my sister's writings, her students' writings. And I knew, some part of me knew that someday I was going to want to explain what it was like to grow up with my parents. And so I salvaged one little sheaf of papers, which were manuscripts that she had marked up. And there were, you could barely see the black type of the original typing for the red pen marks. That was how I grew up. Not something I replicated with my own three children, you know, who got to like have a somewhat normal life, you know. But what it did was it gave me, I mean, it was an extraordinary education. And I was selling my stories to magazines when I was 12 years old. Again, you know, not really what I believe a kid should be doing. I got up in the morning with a sense of I must create something worthwhile. And I typed. My birthday present when I was 7 was a mimeograph machine. My sister is also a writer. My sister is also a writer. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
The reason why I'm here is because I read the Sunday New York Times really every Sunday and your vows.
Oh, my wedding story. That was a great story. I have to explain. Yeah, I got married this summer, and I actually the first time I did that once before in 1977, and the man I married did it once before in 1973, and we had been on our own, or not on our own, but you know, knocking around. Jim, I think in that article called it in the wilderness for 25 years. We each raised three children, and we found each other, 2 years ago, and we got married, and I didn't seek out that vows column, but one of the invited guests to our wedding was a New York Times writer who suggested it to the New York Times, because people evidently, they're really cutthroat about getting into that column. They're always like, they're jockeying for, they're sending videos and tapes, and but they just asked me, could we cover your wedding? And I thought, oh, some people are going to say, there she goes again, always, showing her life you know, bearing everything. And I thought, no, I want to tell that story because it's such a hopeful story. I'm 59, Jim's 61. And we, you know, some people would write us off, but it was just sort of a happy story. And so, yeah, I encourage you, if you Google my name and New York Times and vows, you'll read a really happy wedding story and see some really nice pictures of Harrisville, New Hampshire. Yeah, thank you. Oh my gosh!
It's going to be our book club book.
Oh!
Everyone on this in my water aerobics class is going to read it.
You know, it was such a cagey marketing move to get married this summer. I Jim thought we were just in love. Little did he know. That's great. Thank you. I love that vows column. It made me really happy. My son, there were so many things that were not in that story, but one of my, all six of our, you know, joined children, you know, were there, and they're ages 25 to 35. And my youngest son, Will, who's 29, got up at the microphone to make a toast to us, and you never know what Will is going to say. So he began by saying, "Ugh, my mom's had a lot of boyfriends over the years." And he was totally capable of like running through the list. And he didn't. He said, "And I have so many emotions on this day, but the chief one is relief." Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I'm just curious how you arrived at the title of this movie.
After, oh God, titles are funny. They're so important. Do you like this title? Let me ask you first.
I'm not sure.
Well.
Why is it called, you know.
You have to read the book to fully. There are two. Oh, you did. Well, there are two meanings to that title. And one is, you know, like after dinner, after we went to the movies, after her, you know, something that comes after something else. And then the other is, you know, when somebody is being chased, when somebody is being pursued.
And it's all on how you pronounce the title.
It is. So that was, I kind of like that. I have to say that there were a million titles that I came up with before this one. And it came to me in a dream. But then I felt really happy about it. So I hope you like the title. I hope you like the book, more important. Did you like the book? Oh, good.
She came from Santa Fe today.
Oh, you're the one. You wrote to me. Yes. Oh, my gosh. How long a drive is that?
6 hours.
Wow. Remind me your name. You're my Facebook friend. Pat. Thank you, Pat. You're going to get a really special drawing in your book. I always, when I sign a book for you, I draw in your book, and Pat will get the best drawing.
Yeah.
Well,
you get the second best.
You might get the pie recipe. I don't know.
Yes. What kind of books do you like to read?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, first I have to say, this is an embarrassing admission. I am an extraordinarily slow reader. And I think I read like a writer. So I read like an editor. I don't have like long lists of books that I've been, you know, when I choose a book, it's a big commitment. Right now I'm reading this collection of Dan Cheon's short stories that I love, but I'll probably be reading it for weeks because I sort of study everyone. But what the common element is, and maybe, you know, I'm reading to study. I never actually got to formally study writing. I mean, I grew up in a household where we were, you know, when I was young, but I left college when I was 18. I never went back. I never studied again. So when I read, I'm studying. And so I read books that I think will help me in what interests me. And what interests me is always human relationships, so-called ordinary. I'm very into so-called ordinary American life. And that's, I go back to that again and again. And I'm, it's might be called narrow, but I'm endlessly interested. I know I grew up feeling that I was an outsider. There's an image that comes up again and again in my books in different forms. I didn't realize this until I was reading the manuscript of this book, and it comes in different forms, but there's somewhere along the line, there's a character looking in a window. Looking at in a window with the lights on and people in the house, and everything looks so perfect. And you were just talking about that. And in this book, the two girls, I love this, and this actually is, this comes from the true experience of these two sisters. Their family had very little money. The cable was disconnected. They didn't have television. And they had this little, and their mother, we would now know that their mother suffered from depression, but that word wasn't really used in 1979. She just kind of checked out. So they were on their own in a way that I thought was kind of wonderful, because I grew up with this mother who was on me all the time. What are you writing? What are you doing? How's, you know, your syntax going? And, you know, so the idea of these two girls who were kind of like wolf girls left to their own devices. Nobody checked their report cards. Nobody, you know, signed them up for extracurricular activities. They were just off on this mountain having these adventures, these crazy, stupid adventures like stretching out their sweatshirt, which those girls really did do, and lying there for hours. You know, they didn't feel like must produce writing, must sell article to Humpty Dumpty magazine. You know, they didn't have that. So they, I lost my train of thought. What was I talking about here? Oh, looking in the window. So they had, thank you so much, Barbie. You are still sharp. Don't worry about it. I, on the other hand, had three glasses of wine. So their cable was cut, and they had this little ritual. They would go out after dinner, dinner being whatever they heated up in the microwave, or just a pack of crackers, yeah, something like. And they would go, they lived in this housing development, this kind of falling down housing development, and there was a whole series of houses that backed up on a hill, and they'd settle themselves behind the picture window of their neighbor's house in the dark. The lights would be on in the house, and they would watch the TV through the windows. There was no sound. They just looked at the, and they had walkie-talkies. That was their big thing. And they would talk to each other and say things like, now Helen is walking out of the room. Now she is sipping a glass of water. But they would watch through the windows. And that image just haunted me. And it was another version of something that I was very familiar with from my own life, which is the imagining that there's some perfect family out there having this wonderful life that you're not having. And they were, and looking through the window. And in the case of these girls, there's sort of two windows. They're looking through a window into a TV set. So it's two stages removed. And one night, in this story, when they're looking through the picture window, who do they see on the television set but their father? Because he's giving a press conference announcing the first of the murders, and he's been very absent in their lives, but suddenly he returns sort of on TV. And that's kind of, you know, what sets the story in motion, that they feel like maybe they're going to get their father back in this odd way. I thought I might just, we're probably getting to the point of winding down, but there's a passage in this book that I love to read, and it's not so much a story passage, but it just kind of came out of nowhere. I was telling this story, and there's a lot of action happening, and then I just wanted to stop everything for a minute and consider it's my narrator speaking, not me, but of course you can probably figure out that a lot of the things that the narrator of a book says are the things that are on the writer's mind. So the woman, these girls have been making just a pile of trouble. Cooking, you know, one of them, the older sister, thinks she's figured out who the murderer is, and she's sending him an anonymous note, and she's cooking up this plot to trap him. And then she stands back, and I'm not going to read the whole of this, but these are a few of the things that she says just before all hell breaks loose. It's not even close to the beginning. It's page, 205, so you know it's right smack dab in the middle. In my 44 years of life, here is something I've learned about 13-year-old girls. I know this as somebody who used to be one long ago and used to be the sister of one and the friend of others and the ex-friend. 13-year-old girls live in two different worlds. They exist like citizens of two distinct countries. And though these two places are as different as Croatia is from Papua New Guinea or Mercury from Saturn, they float between the two as effortlessly as a person might from one side of the Golden Gate Bridge to the other when it's not even rush hour, or from North Beach to Morning Glory Court, more easily than that particular journey, come to think of it. Partly, a 13-year-old girl is still a child, capable of finding joy in setting grass on fire in a tin can, or thrill in the sight of a neighbor answering the ring of the doorbell and opening the door to discover no one there, only a rustle in the bushes. That was one of the games that Laura and Janet used to play. 13-year-old girls can actually believe that the reason they won't get to marry John Travolta is because he's got a girlfriend already, and that Peter Frampton's getting a haircut qualifies as a tragedy, and that receiving a call from a particular boy, or a particular girl for that matter, is the most wonderful thing that ever happened. 13-year-old girls believe in heroic fathers and wicked stepmothers. They believe the words to songs and the advice of other 13-year-old girls, and that the first boy they love, they will love forever. Their bodies, mine anyway, may resemble those of boys more than the bodies of women. But inside the bodies of these girls, something is going on, unlike anything that exists in the bodies of boys, the bodies of men. Their breasts swell, of course. The uterus fills with blood. The longing for touch may feel, to a girl of this age, as real as fire. A 13-year-old girl looks in the drawers of the people for whom she babysits in search of sexual paraphernalia, peels back the wrapper on a condom and blows it up like a balloon, then stuffs it in her pocket to destroy the evidence. And if she finds a blouse or a dress that interests her belonging to the wife of the couple for whom she is babysitting some Friday night, or a piece of lingerie, more likely, she may even try it on. She lies. One day she tells a girl at school that she's the world's first test tube baby. She has pulled her underpants up higher than normal over her waist, so when she lifts up her shirt, she can point to her bare skin and prove it. See? No belly button. Being 13 years old herself, the other girl believes this story. She sends a note, anonymous, naturally, to an unpopular boy in her class, in which she tells him that she knows he wet his pants that time on the bus coming home from the field trip. She is that mean. But she is also capable of great kindness. On that same bus trip, she sat with a cerebral palsy girl, the one who drools. A 13-year-old girl possesses special powers. The same girl who can believe the messages of a Ouija board or the declarations of friendship of someone who, one day later, will walk past her in the cafeteria without speaking, may also, at rare moments, possess the wisdom of a full-grown woman or even a sage. Though it's not wisdom precisely, more like an eerie animal ability to know and hear what nobody else can. A gift of feeling, feeling having overtaken all else, that a few more years of life in the world, or even just a few more months of it, will transform into a distant memory. When she taps into it, and this is an erratic event at best, hers is a different kind of knowledge from the kind the mothers and grandmothers have acquired that comes from lessons learned, years lived on planet Earth. The knowledge 13-year-old girls carry comes from a whole different galaxy, more like it, from some other sense besides the accustomed five, and maybe the heightened acuity of those five combined, but not yet numbed or deadened, as they so often become later, when the business of daily life catches up with her, when she learns to tamp down all the big feelings, deaden her nerve endings, just to get through the day. The knowledge a 13-year-old possesses is more like the ability to recognize a high-pitched sound audible only to dogs, or forms not visible without the aid of 3D glasses, the gift of a blind person may have, not simply to recognize when a person enters a room, however soundlessly, but to know who that person is and whether to trust him. But she will also trust people she shouldn't. many of those.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.